She's considered one of Australia's greatest mathematicians.
I find that mathematics helps me understand the world, and that one thing hasn't changed over my whole career.
Professor Cheryl Praeger turned her passion for the mathematics of symmetry into a long and distinguished career at the University of Western Australia. Her research has had significant impact, and her algorithms are used worldwide in applications from internet search engines to digital communications.
There is always a new problem, and finding a solution gives me such joy and excitement. I just love it when a really difficult problem finally yields.
Cheryl has won many distinguished awards. Among them, she was appointed a member of the Order of Australia for her research and service to mathematics. In 2019, she also became the first pure mathematician to be awarded the Prime Minister's Prize for Science.
It's shining a light on how important mathematics is. I was so thrilled, just amazingly humbled by getting that award.
But just as importantly as her research, Cheryl has worked tirelessly to promote and advance mathematics education. She's also a role model and champion for women in STEM.
I think it feels a lot more of a normal culture in the mathematical disciplines now. I hope it's much more inclusive.
We are so proud and excited to have Professor Cheryl Praeger as this week's guest on The Random Sample. Welcome to The Random Sample, a podcast by the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Mathematical and Statistical Frontiers. I'm Emily DeWayne. In this show, we share stories about mathematics, statistics, and the people involved. You can learn more about what the Centre does by visiting our website, acems.org.au. That's acems.org.au. Our host for this episode is Dr. Savandi Kandanarachi, a lecturer at RMIT University in Melbourne and an ACEMS Associate Investigator.
I'm Savandi Kandanarachi, and I'm thrilled to have Professor Cheryl Praeger with us today for The Random Sample. Cheryl, we warmly welcome you to The Random Sample.
Thank you, Savandi. I'm delighted to be here and delighted to see you again.
Yeah, I thought we can just start by chatting a little bit about your personal history. So you were someone who's always passionate about mathematics, and when you were in high school, you went to see this vocation guidance officer, and who actually discouraged you from doing mathematics. So what happened there?
Well, I was really keen on learning how to study mathematics at university. No one in my family had been to university, and we really needed some advice. So the vocational guidance officer essentially told me, girls don't do maths, they don't pass, and anyway, there are no jobs. So all of those were false. And I got quite upset and then stubborn and angry about this. And we found some more advice by actually going to the University of Queensland and finding out about their courses there. And I won a scholarship to get myself to university and studied a sort of an advanced level maths that they had, honours maths and also honours in physics. So it took me a little while to work out exactly where my path was going to lead. Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Getting more information was like one of the key things, wasn't it, in that story?
Yes. There was another part of it, which was trying to get enough confidence to be brave enough to choose to do mathematics at university, because I'd come from a country school to a city school and realised I had to work much, much harder in the city than I had in the country. And so then I thought, well, if I go on to university, I will be amongst the best people in the whole state. And I wasn't sure if I was good enough to continue with mathematics there. So what the backstory of my gaining enough confidence was that I won or tied for first place in a senior mathematics competition organised by the Queensland Association of Mathematics Teachers. And I had said to myself, if something happens with this competition, then maybe I will have enough courage to try to do maths at university. So when I got my award there, I thought, okay, I'm going to give it a go. So all of that was all mixed in.
Yeah, I see. After the University of Queensland, then you went on to Oxford. So can you tell us a little bit about that journey?
So I, of course, didn't know what kind of jobs there might be for mathematicians. But between my third and fourth year as an undergraduate, I won a vacation scholarship to the Australian National University in Canberra. And that was a real watershed for my life, my career. I saw people working on research in mathematics. I had an opportunity to attend lectures in the Summer Research Institute of the Australian Math Society. So I heard a lot of really cutting edge stuff about mathematics, but also I had my own little research project to be working on over the summer. And it went really well. And I published my first research article as a result of that. And I became passionately wishing to do a PhD in mathematics. I mean, it was that experience that said, well, even if I can't get a job, what I want to do is a PhD in mathematics. And then because my eyes had been opened and going to the ANU, I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fantastic if I had the opportunity to go overseas and do my PhD overseas. So my master's supervisor, I did a master's straight after my bachelor's, Sheila Williams had been a fellow at St. Hugh's College in Oxford, and she recommended that I choose Oxford if I could. And that's what happened. I was able to do that. I won a Commonwealth scholarship to travel to Oxford, and I did my DPhil, as it was called, DPhil at St. Anne's College. It was fantastic.
Wow, yes. So you were in Oxford in the 1970s era. So during that time, were there a lot of women doing mathematics?
Well, there were certainly many more women than I had met while I was a student. So by the time I was in second year undergraduate, I was the only girl in my mathematics classes. From then on, one of 20, one of 12, one of 8. So going to Oxford, there were certainly not a majority of women, but there were quite a number of other women around, and it seemed a much more normal environment as far as me trying to imagine myself studying maths. I had been lucky, although I was the only student who was a girl in my classes, two of my lecturers, Anne Street and Sheila Williams, were fantastic lecturers, and you know, they were at the University of Queensland. So it seemed to me like amongst the lecturing staff, there were some really, really top women. And also I had the privilege of meeting Hannah Neumann when I was doing my vacation scholarship work in Canberra. So I kind of knew that there were women around. And then of course in Oxford, there were some of my my fellow students were women.
So you got to see more and more mathematicians as the journey progressed.
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes. Sharon, how did you come back to Australia and how did you end up in the University of Western Australia?
Oh, there's another few jumps. So I had agreed with the British Council. I'd signed a paper that I would come back to Australia when I'd finished my doctorate. And I was lucky to get a three-year research fellow position at the Australian National University. That was wonderful. I took up my post there in late 1973, and 2 weeks after I started, I was offered a half-year visiting assistant professor position at the University of Virginia. And the ANU were wonderful. They just said, okay, you can have 6 months leave without pay after just working for a couple of months. So I had that half year, which was fantastic. It was a special group theory semester, and I had people in my area flying in every single week, giving lectures. So I had a wonderful experience there. And then back at the ANU, I realized that there were just about no jobs for mathematicians in that time in the 70s. And when I was on my honeymoon. I married John and we had a short honeymoon, and then we went to conferences, maths conferences in Adelaide. I heard that there were four jobs going at the University of Western Australia, two for 2 years and two for 1 year. And so we wrote and applied for them and ended up both of us coming to UWA, me on a two-year position and John on a one-year position. So I was going to get some teaching experience there, but we never ever expected that we would stay there. I mean, it's just serendipitous. Things happen.
So you've stayed there from that time onwards. You've been at UWA.
Yes. Yeah. As my home base. I've done all sorts of different things, but and my job there has changed a lot, but we've stayed there.
Cheryl, going to the vast amount of maths that you've done, your background in algebra, and then you've done things in graphs, groups and combinatorics. How did your love for algebra start?
I guess I liked algebra from my undergraduate experience of learning, and the little research project in Canberra was on a functional equation. It was a discrete problem, but I really, really decided that I loved to study groups and algebra and symmetry when I was in Oxford. My DPhil program there, my problem was about primitive permutation groups, which is groups acting on sets. Not much structure there, but plenty of interesting problems. And it turned out around that period that in a one way to start understanding and make things much more transparent with the group actions was to see that there was a network or a graph underpinning what we were studying. This was introduced by Wieland in Germany and by Higman in the States. They saw that by introducing a combinatorial way of understanding group actions made a whole lot of the theory more transparent and allowed us to solve a lot of problems. And in fact, some of the finite simple groups were discovered via networks and graphs. In particular, the Higman-Sims simple group was actually discovered just this way, by seeing that there was some structure sitting there locally, and then finding the sporadic simple group that was, that was acting on the whole global structure. So many, many exciting things were happening there. And in particular, in the 1980s, early 80s, there was the announcement of the classification of the finite simple groups. And that really changed the face of discrete mathematics, algebra, and anything you do with measuring symmetry of discrete structures was completely changed by that classification. And this happened very early on in my career. And it was actually an issue of trying to understand what should be and could be the consequences of this massively new, powerful tool for studying symmetry.
You've done a lot of stuff on the Onan-Scott theorem, and you've generalized it to various different other objects. What is this theorem about?
Well, Savandi, the finite simple groups are actually the building blocks of abstract groups. I mean, every finite group is built out of a bunch of finite simple groups. But when we're trying to study groups acting on symmetric structures, we want to understand if there are actually building blocks for that sort of symmetry. And the building blocks are not always the finite simple groups. They're a bit more complicated. It's a bit like, you know, the finite simple groups are the atoms, but when we're looking at matter, we're interested in certain sort of molecules or something. So the building blocks for understanding the way groups act on structures were traditionally understood to be the primitive groups. And when the finite simple groups were classified, there was a new way of working with and studying the building blocks of group actions, the primitive permutation groups. And that was called the Onan-Scott theorem, because two people independently expressed this theorem more or less at the same time. So Michael Onan and Leonard Scott. So the Onan-Scott theorem divides up the primitive groups into a small number of types. And the object is to make it easier to apply the finite simple group classification. And it's using this Onan-Scott theorem that we first were able to solve some really tough open problems. Maybe the first one was the Sims conjecture, which could be thought of as a conjecture about symmetries of graphs as well as a group theoretic problem. And then later on, I was studying symmetries of larger families of graphs, things which are called S-arc transitive graphs, where you're tracking little paths of length S, not just single edges in the graph. And I realized that in understanding that larger class of graphs than we'd been looking at before, you could not reduce down and say that the building blocks are going to have these primitive groups acting. Instead, you needed this larger group of the groups which had been named, they'd been called quasi-primitive groups. So you could track it down to quasi-primitive groups, but nobody had studied them. They'd named the concept, they'd not studied them at all. So one of the things I did was to work out that there was an Onan-Scott theorem that described the structure of the quasi-primitive groups. And alongside of that, I worked out this new way of sort of cutting up or reducing the S-arc transitive graphs down to the basic ones where you might find a quasi-primitive group acting. And so it was possible then to use the symmetries to construct a theory to describe and help us understand this larger class of graphs. And now, both using quasi-primitive groups and also using this normal quotient reduction method is just used all over the place to understand finite classes of graphs which have got a pretty big symmetry group.
Wow, yes. You've done, like, you know, a lot of research on these topics, and, like, you know, they're related, interrelated bodies of research, and you've written over 420 journal papers. That is, in mathematics, that is such a big, big, big number. So would some of the things that you said, would there be any favorite papers at all?
Wow. Oh, I love all my papers, almost all of them. Choosing some favourite. One of the favourites would have been the paper I published about the Onan-Scott theorem for quasi-primitive groups and the normal quotient reduction method. So that was all in one paper. Another favourite is my first memoir with Martin Liebeck and Jan Saxel about maximal factorisations, because that was hitting into the internal structure of the finite simple groups themselves. We were classifying ways in which they could be factorized in a sort of maximal way. And that helps to identify additional symmetry for structures. And the third thing that I think is really important was my paper with Peter Neumann on the special linear group recognition algorithm. Because that was a completely new algorithm of its type, where we were wanting to work with matrix groups. And it seemed like computationally, you had wonderfully strong methods by Charlie Sims to work with permutation groups. And you could work with them up to really large sizes of sets. But for the matrix groups, there was just nothing comparable available for us to work with. And so our theorem, our algorithm that we designed and analyzed and got this complexity algorithm, complexity analysis for it, was completely new. That what you're trying to do is answer this question. Someone hands you two or three matrices over a finite field. So we're looking at finite things here. And they say, can you tell me that when you multiply these all together in any order, any number of times, whether you can come up with every single determinant one matrix, at least, whether you can find the special linear group there. And so our answer was, yes, and here's how you do it. And proving that what we're suggesting that you do, proving that it's true, actually relies on the full force of the finite simple group classification. So it's a really deep algorithm. It uses randomization. It's, you know, it's analysis, makes use of, you know, probability distributions on groups. And we use the finite simple group classification instead of doing lots of very expensive computations. So it's amazingly fast, amazingly effective. And this launched a huge project, which is now pretty close to being finished, where we now have a very, very good computer system for computing with finite groups of matrices over finite fields. So I love that paper too, because it was just so different. All these things took years and years to complete. And that one probably took us 3 years to write down all of the details. And by that time, everyone was starting to think about what else you could do, how you could use these ideas to help with group computation.
Cheryl, you've received many awards, many top awards, both in and outside mathematics. So in 2019, you got the Prime Minister's Prize for Science. You were the first pure mathematician to receive this prize. Can you talk about that a bit?
Oh, I think of that award, receiving the Prime Minister's Prize for Science, as something really, really special, because it's a national award and it's shining a light on how important mathematics is. I was so thrilled, just amazingly humbled by getting that award. And I was also the first person living in Western Australia to receive the Prime Minister's Prize for Science. So it was something very special, and I think it has led to mathematics being a little bit more visible, and also the fact that I was a woman in STEM receiving that prize. I'm hoping that it feels a more normal, more natural place, that women can seek to be really good in the STEM area. All those things, all these layers of lovely things associated with it.
Yes, and recently you were awarded the first ever Ruby Painscott Medal and Lecture by the Australian Academy of Science. And so this is an inaugural award, and Ruby Painscott was an Australian pioneer of radio physics and radio astronomy. She also had a remarkable son, and that's Peter Hall. Peter Hall was the ASIM's inaugural director as well. And I've heard that you worked with Peter Hall as well in your career.
Yes, we Peter Hall and I have worked together more in the service of mathematics. We were together on the review panel for mathematics research in the UK for several weeks, some decades ago. And I have enormous respect and admiration for Peter's contributions to mathematics and statistics in this country and across the world. So I had the great pleasure of working with Peter. Unfortunately, I never knew his mother. I think she died quite early, but I read a whole lot about Ruby Painscott, and I feel so grateful to his mother. She had to give up her career as a radio astronomer because there was no provision for maternity leave. And she fought very hard and did not succeed for herself to be able to continue her work as a woman in science. And I'm just one of the many, many people who now are able to have careers in science. So I feel very, very grateful to Peter Hall's mother, Ruby Painscott. And I was so very, very happy, just really, really thrilled to get the Ruby Payne Scott Medal.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask, like, how did you feel when you got this award? So you've answered that. Yeah, it's wonderful to hear you to speak about these things, and also it's wonderful to see you, because you bring such warmth and, you know, enthusiasm and, like, you know, honesty kind of thing. Yeah, it's sure. This is a question that I really want to know. How does a person become a good researcher?
That's such a tough question. You work really hard. You work with other people. You learn about how to write nicely for some others, how to explain what you're doing, so that you think about where the research is going and perhaps how it fits with the knowledge that we have at the moment, and how you're finding something new. And I think there's an issue of having a vision for what you know now, what you would like to know, so that you don't just do something because you can do it, but you think, what is it that would really help us understand this problem better? So that you're really thinking not just inside of the mathematics and the problem you're looking at right now, but where you would like to see it moving in the future. Now, some of that could also get you in a big fix and depressed because you can't solve a problem. So I guess it's also got to go alongside with the understanding that sometimes you will drop a problem because it isn't working, and you'd start to think maybe more sideways at where else you could move and change the problem. I don't think I'm answering this very well.
No, those are really, really good things, because, yeah, I think that's great what you're saying.
I also had an experience when I had two little children. They were very, very young, and I was so tired. They didn't sleep very much, and I was trying to do everything, of course, trying to be a mother and be a mathematician. And I felt like I was not going to be able to think another creative thought in my whole life. So I went to my colleagues around Australia and I said, is there a problem that I could work on with you where my skill set would be of some use? And so several of my colleagues said yes. So I've got problems in the mathematics of weaving. I've got problems in height distribution on classes of trees and combinatorics. I've got problems on all sorts of things where my inclusion in that research was as a result of the generosity of a colleague in including me. So there are many different parts of our lives where we can take advantage and grasp opportunities when they're offered. And I think that also is part of learning new skills, reaching out, being willing to consider completely different problems. And of course, I did get some sleep eventually. And so I was able to start asking my own questions in research and building up my own research group.
Yeah. Yes, I think, like, you know, with motherhood and, like, with little children, that the feeling of exhaustion, in a way, it's reassuring to hear that someone like you have had that thought, like, will I ever do, like, you know, something like that? Because I think it's very common in that phase of time where you're not getting the sleep and there's everything and constant interruption, especially with COVID, with you know, people working from home and you know, little children being at home. Cheryl, you've been promoting mathematics at various levels, like from high school level to university and beyond. In 2003, you have this article that was, you've written this article saying mathematics, beauty, truth, and the real world. And then you say this article that the number of students studying advanced maths in Australia is decreasing. This was in 2003. Mm-hmm. So Do you think this is still the case, or like, do we have a problem?
I think Australia still has a problem because the demand for mathematically trained students, workers, is just going through the roof. I mean, mathematics is so important. We need great problem solvers. We need people who can think critically and logically, who just have those skills, skills in mathematics, in using computation, in using, you know, all the things that we learn. We need many, many more of them. And somehow we're not producing enough. We need talented maths teachers as well. I mean, we needed them in teaching, education, in statistics, in industry, engineering, commerce. I mean, these people are needed everywhere and throughout science, because mathematics is a fundamental part of every part of the STEM disciplines. And I don't think we're getting enough of these kids studying advanced maths at school. Maybe the reward structure was wrong, and that they're taking a lower level maths, which is kind of cutting them off from being able to advance really quickly into the sorts of exciting options that they might wish to learn about and study at the university. So I wish that we could encourage more students to take advanced maths at high school. And there's many people who are trying to take this on. I know ASEMS has got its own programs, and the Australian Mathematics Trust, with its challenge and enrichment challenges for young people and its competitions, and AMSI with its outreach programs, Choose Maths, which involved BHB for a number of years. So many people around the country are trying to do lots of different things. Every university has an outreach program. Some of them are fantastic. And this whole mosaic is surely going to help. And I hope that all of these programs are going to strengthen each other. But I don't know how we get to be heard by the decision makers who may understand how urgent and important this problem is.
You've been involved in many different organisations like the Australian Mathematical Trust, and then also the Curriculum Development Council of Commonwealth Schools Commission, Prime Minister's Science Council, WA Science Advisory Committee. So all these are in an effort to boost the mathematics education in high school.
The last ones were looking at education across the board, I guess. So the Curriculum Development Council was producing initiatives for education in all core areas from kindergarten to year 12. And that was an amazing, amazing experience for me. Quite a steep learning curve. I didn't know much about that when I started, but I surely got taught a lot. So I think mathematics is part of an extremely important part of a wide educational initiative, and Australia needs kids who have all these skills, and we need to be able to understand how mathematics fits in with the rest of our educational programs and drive. Like at the moment, ACARA is producing a new mathematics curriculum. There's a lot of debate that I see on the internet, and I'm hoping that we will end up with a stronger, more vibrant mathematics curriculum in schools, and that this will enthusiastically attract both teachers and students to study maths, to get better and achieve their potential.
Sharon, so as... I mean, I'm amazed how you manage to, you know, do it all. Like, you know, you're doing the research and like you're doing all these outreach activities to promote mathematics at various levels. I'm simply simply amazed at that. But what can we do, like in the sense, say me as a lecturer or anyone else in the university, to promote maths at the high school level, because we know it is really important.
Oh, what can we do? We can volunteer. We can find out what's happening. There are wonderful programs through the Australian Maths Trust, and I've been working with them for many more than 20 years. I think 1992, I was an inaugural board member of the Australian Maths Trust, and then shortly after, I became chair of the Australian Maths Olympiad Committee. So you asked me, how does a young person get involved? I guess you think about where you would like to, what you'd like to see, and you would be welcome in many different areas, wherever your passion leads you. So your university may have outreach programs. So there's things like this wonderful Girls Maths Day at the University of New South Wales. I remember being the maths ambassador 1 year, just a couple of years ago there. There's many things happening, or through the Maths Teachers Association. There's wonderful opportunities there.
You've been like really a big influence, increasing female participation in mathematics in Australia. What is the reason that you're so passionate about it?
I don't know, Sivandi. I find that mathematics helps me understand the world, and that one thing hasn't changed over my whole career. There is always a new problem, and finding a solution gives me such joy and excitement. I just love it when a really difficult problem finally yields. And I like it even more if I'm discovering that with a group of collaborators, so we can all be happy together. But I find the progress and the understanding just exhilarating. And I'd love it for other people to be able to have this joy as well.
So, Cheryl, you've done a lot of things on the women in mathematics front. Can you tell us about a couple of recent things that you've done?
Sivandi, I'm still associated through the International Mathematical Union with Women in Mathematics. The IMU set up a committee for women in mathematics, and I'm a member of that committee for this four-year term. That started in 2019. I've been chairing the scientific committee for the second international conference for women in mathematics that will be held the day before the next International Congress of Mathematicians in St. Petersburg. Let's hope that's actually going to happen. Yes. So that's one thing that we've done. But next year will be the 50th anniversary of the Association for Women in Mathematics, the US body that was started. And it's really Association for Women in Mathematics. So members are men and women who are supporting women's participation in our discipline. And there's going to be a Springer book published to celebrate that 50th anniversary. And various countries have been asked to write accounts of what's been happening for women in mathematics in their country. So Leslie Ward and I have very recently completed a paper about the Women in Mathematics Special Interest Group, WIMSIG, of the Australian Mathematics Society, talking about how that came about, what it does, what it has done in the past, what it hopes to do in the future, talking about all the different wonderful programs that WIMSIG runs and hopes to run. So that was a great achievement, because both Leslie and I were just so, so busy. I think we only just managed to make those deadlines.
Cheryl, you were also among the many positions you've held. You were the first female president of AustMS. This was in 1992. Have you seen like the landscape change from that to right now?
Oh, it's changed enormously. in some ways I felt when I was president of OSTMS that I was there because someone thought it was a good idea. And as I suggested, maybe it would be a good idea to have another woman president of OSTMS, it was not considered to be a priority for many, many years. Like, it was many, many years before the next woman president, Nalini Joshi, was imposed. But now it seems a much more normal occurrence to have both men and women serving and leading as presidents of the society. So that we've seen Kate Smith Miles, we've seen Jackie Ramage. So I think it feels a lot more of a normal culture in the mathematical disciplines now, with both men and women, and hopefully non-binary, and I hope it's much more inclusive. I love the fact that the OSTMS now has an equity and diversity committee, which is looking at many, many different aspects, certainly not just gender, but is really trying to make the society and the mathematical community lots more inclusive.
As a person who've got, who've been awarded many prestigious awards, there's this, an underlying understanding, sort of, that women generally apply less for awards because, you know, they feel, oh, maybe they're not worthy enough, this is a part of the standard work that I do, I shouldn't get an award for it, or whatever these different kinds of things that they go on in people's minds. What can be done about it?
I think what can be done about increasing the number of women recipients of awards, yeah?
Yeah.
I think two things. You can say yes if someone asks if you'd like to be nominated. And you can think about getting organised to nominate others. For example, when I was written by the University of Western Australia Convocation, that's the alumni group there, to congratulate me on receiving the Companion of the Order of Australia, the letter said, can you suggest other people whom we should nominate for Order of Australia? And I thought, well, what a great idea. So, you know, they're thinking about people who are alumni of the University of Western Australia. We could be thinking about people within the mathematical community and thinking about some of us nominating our colleagues who have done amazing things for mathematics, for the community, for Australia. So we could think about getting together with a group of us to nominate someone. I know when I was president of the Australian Mathematical Society, it occurred to me that someone should nominate Professor B.H. Neumann, Bernard Neumann, for an award in the Order of Australia. And I thought, well, now I'm president, I should be able to do that. So I talked to some colleagues and I wrote to lots of people trying to get some support to work out how you did it. I had no idea how you would do this, but, you know, there must be people that know these days. So one of the people I wrote to was Sir Mark Oliphant from the Australian National University. And he was one of the architects of ANU. He was the person who had recruited Bernard and Hannah Neumann to come to Australia in the first place. And he wrote back to me and saying, well, he was so glad I was doing this and it was about time that somebody did. I think some of us together can just take the time to nominate others of us for awards. And the other thing is, if you are nominated, you can't expect your nominator to know everything about you, and so you have to help them. So getting nominated isn't just a passive process. You say yes, but you're actually accepting to help with the nomination as well.
So yeah,
I see. I think we should be much more better organised to do this.
more nominations collectively.
Yeah, yes. I think mathematics does not do the best for itself by standing back. Other areas in science do a much better job, have much better visibility, and therefore are much better resourced, and that we should be doing a better job at celebrating the contributions of the people in this country.
So it's not a fact, it's not because there are no contributions, there are contributions. We are not of a celebratory nature. Like,
we're too pure, I don't know. too critical of contributions rather than celebrating them.
Right. Yes. Okay. Well, sure. I've never thought of it like, you know, in that way. That's very... So you're actually now retired. You retired in 2017 after 40 years at UWA, mm-hmm. but you're still doing research, aren't you?
Yes, I have two ARC Discovery Program grants that I'm trying my hardest to keep up with and help lead. And so many students and postdoctoral people that I work with, actually I'm finding it hard to, hard to keep up with everything.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So you know, your love for mathematics, it's you're working on more exciting problems and just advancing the...
Yeah, because there's so many other things that creep in at the same time. So I'm chair of the Women in Science and Engineering Committee for the Asian Science Academies Network, ASA. And we've got a project, we've got funding for a project to set up a branch of the STEM Women Profiles database that the Australian Academy of Science hosts, which showcases 3,000 plus women scientists. And I hope that it also, you're one of those scientists that's profiled there. And if you're not, I will send you the details of how to do it. But we're going to set up a STEM Women Asia Pacific branch to showcase the gifts and contributions of women in science across the Asia Pacific region. That, and I'm also chairing a steering committee for a government funded project to try to measure the effect of COVID-19 on the careers of women in STEM across the Asia Pacific region as well. And so these things are just taking bits and pieces of my time all the time. And so I'm trying to find maths to do around the edges. All that time is so, so difficult to find.
Sharon, so finally, I wanted to ask, what is your message to you girls who are in high school and maybe in primary school? So if they're, so who are considering an education or a career in mathematics?
Oh, if a girl is considering a career in mathematics, I would say, if this is your passion, just go for it. Try it out. Get as much preparation as you can. Do the best courses you can at school, but please just grasp all your opportunities and follow your dreams, and please do become one of our future mathematicians.
Sharon, thank you so much. It's fascinating talk to you. You know, you give such a lot of energy and like it's inspiration, and your humbleness amazes me. It's beyond words to see such a high profile mathematician, like well known. So thank you so much for coming to the Random Sample, and yes, we wish you all the best for the future and all the best with your research and all the other projects that you're doing.
Thank you, Savandi, and my best wishes to you too.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Random Sample, a podcast brought to you by the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Mathematical and Statistical Frontiers. If you like what you heard, please rate us on iTunes, because we think stories about maths and stats are worth sharing, and we want others to discover that as well. You can learn more about what we do at acems.org.au. That's acems.org.au. And you can find us on social media by searching at acemathstats. That's at acemathstats. We'll see you next week with another story from within ACEMS. Bye for now.